Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get it. No intro music. And yes, I did that on purpose. That was why it was a pause right there. I wasn't expecting intro music to jump in. It's professional, sir. Please don't believe that was an accident. Anyway, this is Speaking Like You Think of Radio. I'm your host, Naj, joined by the all-star co-host once again, the great Chandler Knight. Chandler, what's good, man?
Nothing. Good day.
Sir, that wasn't enthusiastic enough. I got coffee in me now. I'm trying to get juiced up, ready for the show. We got a show full of no topics, but we're still going to get it done. Somehow.
Okay.
Somewhat. Anyway, though, man, I guess you already know. I know you want to get into some baseball. Before we do any of that, dude, this football offseason that we looked at right now, where the signings are going, and most of these signings are kind of dictated by how the market is played. You're seeing teams play for strategy as far as how much they're going to spend or how much they're willing to spend. How do you feel about your Jets right now in their dealings with Ryan Fitzpatrick and the way that that's going?
Well, one, I never wanted Ryan Fitzpatrick as my quarterback because I knew when it came time for the rubber to meet the road that he was screwed up, and he did. I don't want him back as my quarterback. I always felt that Geno Smith never got a fair shot because he wasn't ready to start when they threw him in there. I thought Geno Smith should have still gotten a chance to start last year, regardless of all the nonsense about $600. But for whatever reason, this new coaching and management regime doesn't particularly care for Geno. And New York, the Jets fans never gave the kid a shot, even though, again, he was nowhere near ready to be a starter when they put him in there. So you got what you should have gotten from a player who wasn't ready. So as far as I'm concerned, Ryan Fitzpatrick can go pack sand. If they give him the money he's asking for, go ahead.
Right, right. But hold on. Before we get to the money, I got to add on the Geno Smith situation. That Jets fan base made it a situation where they had to keep Ryan in there. He was playing with weapons that most NFL quarterbacks would have been happy with. And I think it was weapons to where Geno would have been just as successful as Fitzpatrick was. But that fan base has a weird kind of hate for Geno. And I don't think Todd Bowles could have put him in there.
I think he could have put him in there because as long as Geno would have won with them, then they would have accepted it. For whatever reason, the Jets fan base didn't want Geno Smith as quarterback. And yet, Bryce Petty, who is exactly in the same position Geno was, coming out of the same type of system, who had similar numbers, and there's no difference between them other than the color of their skin, somehow Bryce Petty is loved with this fan base and Geno Smith isn't. I have my thoughts on that because most of the Jets fan base out in Long Island, which isn't the most color-friendly place to live. I'm from New York, and I think that's where it's been from a lot of the Jets fan base. I really do when it comes to the quarterback. The same thing happened with Ray Lucas. So, you know what I'm saying? The same fan base that killed Ray Lucas and swore up and down he was terrible, never gave him a shot either. So,
and that's an interesting one, too, you bringing up those two quarterbacks. Both system quarterbacks. Both not really big arms, not really athletic, but both grew up in football. They know the whole passing tree, but, not great talent, I guess you could say. But Geno's never really been given a fair shake. This was the year where you could finally see whether he could sink or swim, and they never got to see it. And now they're dealing with Ryan Fitzpatrick. And, they kind of got him over a barrel, though, because the rest of the league knows what he is. Nobody's going to throw anything crazy at him. So the Jets are basically saying, look, okay, make your market. So, his demands are kind of growing weaker and weaker every day as everybody else gets signed.
Yeah, I think he strikes me the type of guy that unless he gets what he wants, he'll stay at home. Because some quarterback's going to get hurt somewhere. And the fact that Brian Hoyer is being talked about as a viable alternative tells you just where this Jets fan base is with Geno Smith and where the management is with Geno Smith. This shouldn't even be a question. If Ryan Fitzpatrick doesn't want the money they're offering him, which is backup money, which is all he deserves, if that's really all he is a glorified backup, then he can sit at home. You've got some quarterbacks on the roster. Let's see if you drafted well. You have the weapons. You have an offensive coordinator who understands how to maximize the abilities of whatever quarterback he's been with. Chan Gailey, you can say what you want about him as a head coach, he wasn't that great. But as an offensive coordinator, the one thing he has always done is maximize the best traits of whatever quarterback he's been with, be that running,
yep.
be that pocket, be that a combination. However, whatever that quarterback's best skill set was, Chan Gailey maximized that. So what's the problem? If Ryan don't want the money, then let him stay home. Let him stay home.
Yeah, I think they're going to come to that ultimate conclusion, but I think sooner or later Ryan breaks. I think he takes the money. I think he takes the money and comes in. And that's kind of what the Jets are waiting on, him to come in there hat in hand and decide to take the deal. Because no matter what, that team was not – the success of that team last year was not because of Ryan Fitzpatrick. And I don't know if he's got to outsize the ego because of last season or if his agent just – you know, looking at all the money going everywhere else and thinking that Ryan had more leverage than what he had. But we'll see how that one plays out. The more interesting story to me is RG3 in Cleveland. You got Hugh Jackson bringing in RG3. If it works, Hugh's a genius. If it doesn't work, you have to draft another quarterback next year. What are you looking at with Cleveland, especially with that number two pick sitting there, too? Are we seeing brighter times for the Cleveland Browns?
No, because I think they're going to draft the quarterback. I think they're going to take kid out of South Dakota State or North Dakota State, and who I'm not impressed with at all. Again, he was there for 5 years. He was only a starter for two. So I'm tired of people telling me how great he was in a pro-style offense when he only started for two seasons out of five, first of all.
Yeah.
But I think Cleveland is going to draft him. With the money that they gave Robert, he's really only on a one-year deal. He's mm-hmm. there while they groom that quarterback that they're going to draft with the number two pick. I understand that was the only place he could go, and I think it kind of sucks. It speaks to the nonsense with the NFL because somehow there's character concerns about Robert Griffin, yet the Denver Broncos are talking about bringing in Johnny Manziel.
it gets laughed at after a while.
I don't understand that one. I really don't understand that one because last I said, Robert Griffin hasn't had multiple charges of domestic violence, hasn't been in a rehab, you know, hasn't showed up drunk, hasn't lied to any organization, but somehow his character concerns with Robert Griffin, and there's nothing with Johnny. But anyway, I think
that's the problem with the word character in the NFL. It's become a catch-all. You just throw it out there, and, you know, it's so vast as far as what character concerns are and what you determine is a bad guy that is different for every organization, and the levels to it don't make any sense. So, like you just said, that dynamic with RG3 and Johnny Manziel, the fact that those two names are put in a sentence with character, like, lets you know that it's become a meaningless word in the NFL.
Yeah, it's a way for people to justify blacklisting a guy. Because I think Cleveland was the only legitimate place that RG3 could go. So I don't blame him for taking the deal. He's had a year off to heal, which is, in my mind, the reason that he was never successful once he got hurt. He never took the time to heal. He rushed back from every injury, which was held against him, by the way, whereas every other quarterback would be lauded for that. Somehow it was looked at as a character flaw for him that he rushed back. You know what I'm saying?
Even though the coach who drafted him set up that dynamic by drafting a quarterback in the same draft. So, of course, he's going to rush back from injury. This is the NFL. You lose your job being hurt. That's the way it goes. So, yeah, and which is why nobody else does that. You don't draft a quarterback as your franchise guy and then draft another guy, early. What was it, the fourth round for Cousins? You don't do
no,
that.
No, second round. It was second round.
Yeah.
They drafted Cousins in the second round. And that's because you had the owner. Yeah, the owner made the pick for RG3, and the coach made the pick for Cousins. So he was set up to fail there. But in Cleveland, Hugh Jackson is a good offensive coordinator. He made Andy Dalton a boatload of money. And you know how I feel about Andy Dalton. I think he's terrible. So I think he'll do the same for Robert in one season. He'll build his confidence back up. with Robert finally being healthy again, I think he will get close to being what he was. I don't think he'll ever be what he was because of the knee injuries. But if he went from, say, 4-2 speed now to 4-3-5, that's still pretty doggone good for a quarterback. Okay, he still has a cannon for an arm. So I think that all in all, this was the best thing that Rob could do for himself. You go to Cleveland. Listen, the bar, the expectations are low in Cleveland. All they want to listen, if he goes 7-9, okay, he'll be hailed as a savior in Cleveland. They might not be able to get rid of him, okay? When you look at some of the quarterbacks they've had over the past few years, if he goes 7-9 or, God forbid, 8-8, because that team is decimating, if that team goes 8-8, they might build a statue of Robert Griffin in Cleveland, okay? So, you know, all he's got to do, man, is basically not throw interceptions, play within himself, and if he can get that team to play 500 ball, dude, listen, he'd be the greatest thing in Ohio since sliced bread.
And you know what the interesting thing about that is, if he does ball, then they got the best contract you could ever get for a franchise-type talent playing quarterback for you. So you get another year of him on that deal and no injuries or anything like that in 2 years. If it looks good, then you throw everything at him and make him your franchise guy. If it doesn't work out, you didn't lose anything. And I'll throw this out. The alternative to taking that QB at number two is I think they're driving up the market for it, and I think they trade down. And in this draft where there's a lot of O-line and D-line talent, I think they upgrade the team because you let Robert fail or succeed, and then next year you draft your quarterback in a much better QB class. I don't think you reach for Wentz this time.
See, that would make sense, except it's the Cleveland Browns. and I just can't get past the fact that it's the Cleveland Browns, and they always do something stupid. I mean, look at and it might work with this non-traditional front office, but they don't have anybody in that front office that's ever drafted a football player before. No one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got a bunch of guys crunching numbers. So I don't know how it's going to work. Now, if it works, great. You understand what I'm saying? But I'm no fan of Paul D. Podesta from baseball. I didn't think he was that great as an evaluated talent in baseball. So I certainly don't think he's a great evaluated talent in football since he's never done it. But it seems the smart thing to do would be drive up the price of that pick, trade back, get a boatload of picks for that number two, okay, and rebuild, restock your franchise. Because basically the next two drafts are what they're going to use to springboard this franchise forward. You need two drafts to rebuild and replenish. You need two drafts, not one. You need two.
For as many picks as they missed on, they definitely need two. And like I said, you pick somebody on that O-line or that D-line and really solidify that team and make it to where you can really compete. And, you know, you can have that whole city rocking. Like, you can turn it into a whole other thing. And a lot of this is built on Robert, the fact that he has to stay healthy, the fact that he has to work with Hugh and figure out a scheme that he's comfortable with, which I think could be some really good stuff when you really, really consider it. And, you know, I'm a little more optimistic than I thought it would be about
Antonio Pierce. I'm sorry. Antonio Pierce the other day said something I'd forgotten about when he went to the Redskins. Remember Patrick Ramsey?
Mm-hmm.
And remember that for one season, Patrick Ramsey looked like he might turn out to be good? That was Hugh Jackson. I'd forgotten about that. I'd totally forgotten about that. Then Hugh Jackson left, and we realized what Patrick Ramsey really was because the next offensive coordinator didn't know how to maximize his talent. So I'm actually a lot more optimistic with Robert working with Hugh Jackson now than I was because I had totally forgotten about – listen, I had forgotten the name Patrick Ramsey, okay?
The idea that he took snaps, let alone won a few games, you know what I mean? That's definitely a gold star to add to Hugh Jackson's legacy of building up bums. But, I don't know, like I said, it's the Cleveland Browns, man, so, you know, take it for what you want to take it. Like you said, 7-9 or 8-8. Would be considered a really successful season. We're not asking them to make the playoffs. We're not asking them to get to a second round or anything like that. We just want to see if RG3 can put himself back together with the help of Hugh Jackson and the rest of that roster can kind of fill out. Because the defense isn't bad. The O-line, you still got Joe Thomas on it. You know what I mean? He's a franchise guy. They lost Alex Mack to the Atlanta Falcons, but, I mean, at that rate, why pay for another – why pay that much for a center? So I think they made the smart move over Atlanta on that one. But, well, we'll see, man. We'll see. Last week we didn't get to talk about Kirby Smart and UGA. And I wanted to get your opinion on this, but we were kind of skipping through things. So this whole idea of not letting people transfer to a certain school because you consider, you know, Mark Richt is now the enemy, so you don't want him going there, and you want to cut that off right now. Why do coaches feel that they have that kind of that they have that kind of freedom to make that kind of decision? And how is that decision being made and not being just, you know what I mean, just really talked about in recruiting circles to where, look, man, if it don't work out, this guy, he's willing to stop you from going where you want to go. Like, how is that something that we consider normal?
Because that's where it's always been. And this is why I've always said the players should get paid. Because college athletes are the only college students that are treated differently than everybody else. If I go on a full-ride scholarship as a chemistry major, biology major, IT, whatever discipline you want, okay, I can transfer anytime I want. I can take a job and make as much money as I want. I can have people give me money. I can have people walk up to me and hand me a bag full of cash and say, this is for your schoolwork, kid. But somehow the college athlete is supposed to be content with just the scholarship. Just the scholarship. Somehow the college athlete is only worth what they're willing to give him, but every other college student has the ability to basically engage in free enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
The NCAA is making billions off these kids. They've got the antitrust provision, so they ain't paying a lot of taxes. Okay, they got all of these federal subsidies they're getting because of the so-called amateur athleticism, which is not amateur athletics. It's indentured servitude, for lack of a better term. And this is supposed to be okay. And then you get these coaches who can literally destroy your kid. They can hold up your transfer as long as they want. Okay, not to mention the fact that you already got to sit out a year. They can hold up your transfer. They dictate where you go. And this is the way, but the coaches can jump from team to team to team to team to team to team. The head coach, Stephen F. Austin, the minute they lost
Jared
the
Hare.
Public tournament, the minute they did not listen, as he was walking off the court, he was signing a contract with a new school.
Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't have to sit out. There's no penalty except whatever they negotiated in his contract beforehand about leaving, a buyout clause, anything like that. But besides that, yeah, you just walk away to greener pastures, new job, everything you told those kids about, you know, family and team and all that stuff goes out the window. Now you move to your next project and you tell those kids the same thing. And
right.
A bigger school.
And you know what? If you want to go make more money, I'm never going to fault anybody for taking a better job. Okay, because the object of this whole exercise, the point of going to college is what? So you can get a good job, right? Isn't that the point of going to college?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just to get a degree. Yeah. It's so that you can make it, so that you can do better than your parents did or whoever raised you. You understand what I'm saying? It's so that you can do better than whatever you were brought up in, unless you were brought up in a whole lot of money, now you're supposed to even make even much more money. Okay, but the object is to do better. So if I have an opportunity to make money, why are you stopping me from making money? The coach gets to make money, but I can't make money. And then Kirby Smart, with what he did, I'm going to say the Kirby Smart experiment at Georgia will last 3 seasons. And then he'll be gone. But see, he strikes me as somebody who's starting out thinking he's Nick Saban. Like, he has he's got some body of work that says, oh, I'm going to dictate all kind of stuff. Dude, nobody even knows who you are, let's be quite honest. Nobody knew your name until last year. So I give that about 3 seasons, and then Kirby Smart will be gone.
Now, look, I hope you're right on that, because the amazing thing about the UGA coaching search was the best qualified guy is somebody who went to your school and played for your school, huh? It just worked out like that. These hires typically go bad to where you say he's an alum, we know him, we love him, he's a saving guy, You're like, okay, how instrumental was he in being a saving guy? And down here in Georgia, they love stuff like that. The Georgia Tech head basketball coach was just fired, Brian Gregory. Why was he hired?
Yeah.
Oh, he was on Mike. He was on Tom Izzo's staff. He's an Izzo guy. He's an Izzo guy. That has nothing to do. This whole coaching tree madness. At a certain point, people have to be realistic about it and talk about who's actually the one who's bearing those fruits. And usually, it's that head guy who's a special guy. And just because you're sitting there next to him and helping with drills and things like that, that doesn't mean you can go duplicate the same somewhere else. And that Izzo tree has shown that. And the Saban tree is showing that so far. So, yeah, I'm really not that hyped up about this one. I do think it can go bad quickly. His whole thing now is toughness, and they got to change the culture. You know, of course, the same words they always say. But they're kind of running the game that Mark Richt ran, a soft program, and now things are going to be hard and tougher. So that's kind of
right.
The sale right now down here.
Yeah, and that coaching tree crap, I mean, the last coach I know to be successful that came from a previously successful coach is Mike Krzyzewski from Bobby Knight. You know how long ago that is? Nobody from Boeheim, nobody from Roy Williams. Well, no, Roy Williams came from Dean Smith. So you got Dean Smith and Bobby Knight are the last two guys to produce an assistant coach who went on to become a good head coach. That's kind of going way back.
Yeah. When you start talking about greatness, well, usually what you see is those guys move from job to job, and they keep getting the job because they're attached to whatever, you know, major figure, and they got that on their resume, and they just run that into the ground. Hell, there was a coach, Buzz Peterson, who was getting jobs off. He was Michael Jordan's teammate and Michael Jordan's friend for years. You know what I mean? Like, there are certain things you can put on your resume and highlight, man, and it'll get you hired. So,
yeah.
I'm right with you on that, man. These coaches should not be allowed to transfer without having to sit out like the players do. Whatever you want to do to the players, the coaches should have done to them. That's my thinking on this. So as long as the players don't get paid, pay the coaches in classes. If a scholarship is enough for them in education, then it should be enough for you. So you should be able to go up there, take some classes, and figure out how you're going to get to the NBA where you can get paid professionally. Because this is amateur sports, right? So what you need $5 million for, buddy?
Especially when their kids get to go to that school for free. They get a house for free. Okay? They get all of this stuff for free. So it's not like you got to pay bills. I mean, you got to pay utilities, but you ain't having to buy no new home, which means you ain't paying a mortgage. Okay? They're probably giving you a car. All right? Which means
local radio show, local car, local dealership, local store, some local franchise, somebody, they'll sponsor you a business.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely. The perks never stop, man.
Hey, it's good work if you can get it.
Right. So yeah, I'm right with you on that, man. That Kirby Smart thing just rubbed me the wrong way, just reading it. And we'll move on. We'll just jump around. This Nike story about Steph Curry. I don't know who the Nike exec was, but they're kind of dragging this dude's name through the mud as if he should have known Steph Curry would be this.
Right.
I just don't agree with the premise of this whole idea of Nike really missed out on Steph Curry. They didn't prioritize him. Yeah, because nobody knew. Nobody knew this dude would turn his life around like this. Get the ankles, secure, get a little stronger, start shooting out to 35 feet, start putting up 30 a game. Like, nobody saw this. I don't know. Did you see the article, though?
Yeah, I did. And see, this falls right into the revisionist history that's going on right now with Steph Curry, where they're trying to say, see, and this feeds into what Oscar Robertson and some other guys have been saying. And they're trying to say, oh, you just old and mad. No, because they're removing context from this whole thing. First of all, Steph Curry has been in the league 7 years now, okay?
Yeah.
His first 4 years, he was mentioned in the same breath as T.J. Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Too small, too light, and too injury-prone to be successful. T.J. Ford, and Steph Curry were in the same sentence as the same type of player. Remember how every time T.J. Ford fell, he broke his back? Every time Steph Curry twisted an ankle, he was out 60 games. All right? So now Nike's looking at this, dude, you ain't played over 60 games in a season in 4 years. Why would we give you marquee money? That's the first thing. The second thing is, again, this revisionist history crap with Steph Curry. Steph Curry was looked at as a bust. He was looked at as a bust his first 4 years, not because of talent, but because he couldn't stay healthy. He could not stay healthy. So all these people now want to crown him as the greatest thing since sliced bread. Let's just not even act like those first 4 years didn't happen. Let's act like they didn't happen. Let's act like if he went back in time where he played in the Oscar Robertson era where they didn't have a three-point shot, by the way, and you weren't allowed to shoot from 35 feet, otherwise you got put on the bench forever because coaches ruled the game, not the players. It's just the whole narrative with Steph Curry pisses me off because, again, it's turned in, they just like whitewashed the history of this game, and they've all seemed to have forgotten all the negative things they were writing about that young man until Mark Jackson got there.
And, of course, Mark gets none of the credit. Mark gets all of the blame for the failures, when in reality that roster was just turning over into what it is now. When Mark had it, to start, they were undisciplined. They didn't defend. They just wanted to run up and down the court and try to score. Mark systemically put in defensive principles, changed how they played, put some emotion out there, and really made that help that team make a few, make a few leaps. He had problems with management. He got put out the door right when everything was coming in, kind of clicking. But if you think Steve Kerr is a basketball genius beyond reproach, and he can walk into any locker room right now and turn that team into Golden State, you just don't know much about basketball. And it's sad that Mark Jackson is getting a short end like this.
Yeah, and also let's not forget that Golden State – actually had to make a choice between Monte Ellis and Steph Curry, and they almost chose Monte Ellis. People forget that also, that the only reason they kept Steph Curry was because they didn't get any good offers for him, because nobody wanted to touch him because they felt he was too injury prone. So they got better offers for Monte Ellis than they did for Steph Curry. That is why Steph Curry is still in Golden State.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the luck around this situation is amazing. Like I said, the other point would be David Lee getting hurt and them discovering Draymond is a lot better than what they thought. Now you can insert David Lee back in the lineup because Draymond has taken that position and made you a much better team. Like, the luck involved in that team is amazing. But either way, they're damn good. I want to see them compete for this championship, but I do want the historical record to at least be somewhat right. Like, you can't have this team become who they are and act like Mark Jackson didn't contribute to it. Yes, you could say some of his sets were old 90s stuff. Yes, you can complain about him as a coach sometimes. But if you take that critique to everybody in the NBA, I think you're going to find that most of the time with coaches. Like, there's no coach who's out there just, you know what I mean, almost flawless. Even the great Popovich, his greatest mistake, overcoaching in that Miami Spurs game. When he made the substitution. I was led to that Ray Allen thing. Like, everybody makes mistakes, but if you limit somebody to just those mistakes, you can define them that way. And now, because of that, Mark Jackson is considered a bad coach who's only a motivational guy.
Yeah, I mean, look at what Dwayne Casey's doing in Toronto. When he first got to Toronto, his first couple of years, how often were they talking about firing him? Because he was trying to get a foundation in place. And they kept saying, oh, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. The way you're doing things ain't going to work. Working pretty good for Toronto now, though, huh? Working pretty good for them now. Because they stuck with it, and they allowed the coach to actually get his people and his system in and let the players understand what they had to do for this coach for them to be successful with the talent they had. You know?
Yep.
This is not rocket science. At some point, with some coaches, you have to give the coach some time, especially if you keep turning over the roster.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Kyle Lowry's decision to stop eating fast food, change his diet, start working out more, lose all that weight, and come back the way he's looked this season, that's not coaching. You know what I mean? Like for you to have that land in your lap, that's a perfect thing. And, of course, Dwayne Casey being a good coach, he's going to take advantage of it. But he's been dealing with Kyle Lowry in a limited fashion these last few years and still winning, still getting that team as far as they can go. Now, me and you both have had some questions about them as far as playoff games, so we're going to see how, we're going to see if they show up this year. But, you know, Dwayne Casey's not the one to point the finger at in that sense. When you got players who don't show up in big games, that is not a coaching issue. That's a
mirror
issue.
It is. And I think that the reason Lowry finally did that is he finally decided to listen to what his coach has been telling him, that, listen, dude, you can be a star in this league if you commit to being a star. If you just commit to it. DeMar DeRozan, same thing. DeMar DeRozan was a cat who might come out, drop 50, and then not show up for the next 10 games. You know?
Yeah.
So these guys finally decided to buy into what he's saying and commit themselves to their craft. And now they're reaping the benefits of it. You know? I just wish Rudy Gay had listened.
Yeah, that would have been a beautiful thing if Rudy had listened. And with DeMar DeRozan, the amazing thing is, like, something that he struggled with early in his career was, if he missed a few jumpers early, he was putting his head down almost the rest of the game and trying to get to the basket, and he would be scared to shoot the jumper. Now he's got a lot more confidence in the jumper. Even if some don't go down, he's taking the shot when it's there. And, you know, that's a development thing, man. When you see somebody start to develop that kind of confidence in their shooting, which, you know, is still a project with John Wall. John Wall's working on that every day and getting better.
Yeah.
Like, I like to see the progress there. Of young guys like that who are adding not only to their game, but dealing with the weakness. It's real easy to perfect certain things that you can get away with, that your offense kind of leads you to. But when you start shoring up those weaknesses, which is difficult, it ain't you go in the gym and you shoot 100 times one day and you go home. No, it's shoot 1,000 times, 4 days out of the week during the summer. Like, it's heavy work to get it done. I don't think people really get that in order to, you know, change shooting habits and just change, like, your muscle memory for things. Really difficult.
Yeah, it is. And John Wall, quietly, is having an MVP season. If he was on any team other than the Wizards with that terrible coaching, we would be talking about him as in – now, granted, we all know who they're going to give it to, but in my MVP – it's also Russell Westbrook, and then the next name on that list is John Wall for me because of what he's done. Like, John Wall now, you don't just give him a jump shot now. You give him one to see if he hits, because if he hits that one, you're like, okay, I might be in for a long night tonight because he's hit his jumper. Instead of, oh, he hit one, he's not going to hit one the rest of the night. Now, you kind of had your bets on him giving him an open jump shot because you don't want him to start feeling good about it because he's got the rest of the package now. He's passing. He's penetrating. He's creating. He's setting up. He's hitting his free throws. The jump shot was the last piece he needed to add, and he's got it now. At least he's confident in shooting it. His shot still ain't great looking and doesn't always go down, but he's confident in taking the shot. And you and I both know in basketball, sometimes just being confident in taking the shot matters far more than form or anything else.
Hey, Tony Allen was 11 for 11 last week. In some game. I don't know what the hell happened that night. But, yeah, confidence, man. You never know what could happen. But the other interesting thing with John Wall is I see it's an aspect that Kevin Johnson kind of brought to the game, the idea of hot spots. Kevin Johnson was not a good shooter. I don't think anybody would ever say Kevin Johnson was a good shooter. But Kevin Johnson figured out where he could shoot, when he could shoot within their set, and that's what he did. So that free throw line, middle of the court, Kevin Johnson would penetrate, back you down, basically with a few quick moves, and you'd be on your heels. He'd get to that little free throw line spot, his spot, and he'd pull up from right there. He could shoot from there, but he couldn't really shoot. And that's kind of what John Wall is doing now. So when you see him get to that right elbow where he's forcing somebody to step out either on a pick and roll or just beating him around the corner, now he's stopping and hitting that jumper from right there. Right there, he's money. Everywhere else, you know, like you said, you know, it's a work in progress. But just that fact alone, you know, makes him a problem to guard. And teams in the East are hoping the Wiz don't make the playoffs because you don't want to deal with a guy like that. Not in the series.
No. Because in the seven-game series, he can win you two games by himself in a seven-game series. So if they luck up and win one other one, now you're at game seven where it's you know, game seven's a crapshoot at that point. So, no, but and I'm still trying to figure out why Randy Whitman has been fired. I really am. really am.
He must have that Vinny Del Negro to where when they get in those boardrooms, like, that dude talks a good game or something, man. When he comes in that office, he really presents himself well or something. You're right, because it is amazing that he is still there. And that clip of him turning around the whiteboard and Bradley Beal looking at him like he was crazy, that is my number one memory of Randy Whitman as a coach. That is the number one. Of him not being able to figure out the whiteboard.
And the sad part is I like Randy Whitman as a player. And it kills me to do that because I really liked him when he played. You know, I liked him when he played. Him, Brian Winters, I like those guys. But I'm sorry, they both were terrible coaches.
It happens, man. It happens. Just like we talked about in football. You're in those networks, you can get those jobs, but sometimes you might not be for you. Chandler, like I said, Chandler, I'm still flipping around, man. So we're going to go into some other sports. Alfred Morris to Dallas. This one kind of surprised me that nobody else jumped on this because I know everybody's saying now he's a little slower, doesn't have breakaway speed, and he's not the back you want. But for a reasonable price, why wouldn't you pick up Alfred Morris? Like, he's not breaking the bank. I don't understand why people didn't take a flyer on him and allow Dallas to get him.
For the same reason that nobody wanted Chris Ivory, and then the Jets put him in a running scheme that fits what he did well, which is pound him into the line 20-plus times a game, and he's going to get you 90 yards. And, yeah, he's going to get some runs where they're going to catch him from behind, but he's going for a short burst, he'll get you 25 to 35 in a short burst, sometimes 50.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And that's, guess what? Those yards add up. You know what I'm saying? Those linebackers start shying away from taking that hit. Those secondary guys, all of a sudden now, they're not so quick to fill the gap. It's funny how that works. And the same thing with Alfred Moore. You can say what you want. Yeah, he ain't got breakaway speed. You don't need breakaway speed. What I can do, I can get 10, 15, 30, 7, 7, 20, 7, touchdown. It's funny how that works. I didn't break away from nobody, but yet we moved down the field 80 yards, and we got us a touchdown.
And especially on a team to where we saw what Tony Romo is with an effective running game. That Tony Romo year where he had that effective running game, Tony Romo looked like everything that his fans say he is and everything that his critics, you know, go too far on him on as far as criticism, because he was making good plays that year all over. This last year, of course, they decided they do running back by committee. And Romo's going to win us the games. And what happened?
It's amazing, though, that they keep doing this. You have these quarterbacks, and you have a system that's working, and then all of a sudden you want to then say, no, now we're going to put it all in the quarterback to win us the game. There are some quarterbacks who will throw you out of a game before they throw you in the game. That doesn't mean you can't win with them. It just means you have to take the response. You have to put them in a situation where they can't make that throw because you call the running play. And the second play that you called in that same huddle was also a running play. So here's the thing. You're going to run this, or you're going to audible to this run. You're not passing the damn ball. Okay?
and that running game dictates coverages. So you're not going to see nickel all day or some kind of, you know, exotic six D-backs out there because you're Aaron Rodgers. If you're Aaron Rodgers, you're going to see that from time to time. So McCarthy and company have made a concerted effort to run the ball. Didn't work out too much last year because of the injury, but they haven't left it out there to where they're just this air raid offense and we're going to throw it 50 times with Aaron. Now, if they won't do that with Aaron, why the hell would you do that with Tony Romo?
Right. And not for nothing, if that Alabama running back hadn't been eating Big Macs, you know, in between the quarters, they might have had a better season. I'm just saying. You know, Yeah. I'm just saying.
Yeah, man. It's a shame how good he can actually be, and how health is kind of driving him the opposite way. Hopefully he gets it together. Like I said, I know the pressure that's coming. He's going to come back, say he's been a vegetarian, been running marathons. He's ready for the season. So hopefully he's telling the truth when he does say it. But we'll see, man. We'll see. We got another Alabama running back that me and you talked about before. Big fella, runs high, not a lot of change in direction. Has your opinion changed after the combine with Derrick Henry?
Nope. Listen, I just still keep saying to people, tell me the last Alabama running back that was a star of the National Football League that Nick Saban coached. And you can't name one. You can't name one because, one, Nick Saban uses these guys up. Two, they come in there and for some reason, because they basically been men amongst boys, they're not prepared for the level of ferocity that they're getting, and they're not in shape. They're not in shape.
It's kind of like is it kind of like a USC quarterback thing, to where it's like you look really good, but you're playing with exceptional talent at every position, and you're just a cog in it, and we think you're bigger than that. And I think we've seen that with a lot of USC quarterbacks over the years, to where guys were supposedly, you know, going to be the next big thing in the NFL. Then you found out, wait a minute, they were playing with a Hall of Famer, four Pro Bowlers, and 10 guys that made money in the league. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, like Henry, again, I think Henry will be a good running back, but he's not going to be a franchise running back. I think Ezekiel Elliott is a franchise running back, but Henry is not a franchise running back. But if you say use him, say the way the Jets use the Chris Ivory, if your expectations of him are 80 to 90 yards a game, 20-plus carries, moving the pile, moving the chains, then you'll be more than happy with what you get out of that young man. If you expect Todd Gurley, you are in for a rude awakening because that ain't happening. It is not happening.
Right. And not to mention, you put 250 carries on that guy's plate, then you're talking about a whole lot of direct contact and hits, and you're probably shortening his career. So,
exactly, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I like him in the platoon system as you're between the tackles guy or your inside. Anywhere inside.
Yeah, you want somebody – I forget who was. Somebody signed Trent Richardson again? Trent Richardson got a job again?
You see, he had to go get it.
Not yet. Hello? Nah, are you there? I can't hear you.
Yeah. Okay.
I got you.
I guess with the technical difficulties, we're going to have to get out of here. Chandler, can you hear me at all?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Still can't. Okay. We're good.
I can hear you.
Okay. So we're good now then. So let's get into some baseball then before we get out of here, man. So we still got 15 to go. Before we get out of here. Before you go into the big stories, A-Rod, 2017, does he make it that far?
Yeah. He'll play the next 2 years.
And will he get the Kobe closeout, celebrations every year?
No. And that's fine. He doesn't expect it. He's not begging for it like David Ortiz is begging for a standing ovation in Yankee Stadium. He's always carried himself with far more class than other people have treated him with. So good for him. It's out of the way now. He doesn't have to deal with the nonsense. He's going to play his 2 years. His end will be quiet, but his impact on the game won't be.
Great point on A-Rod. One of the most hated all-time greats in any sport. Great thing for A-Rod. So what you got for us baseball-wise, man, that we should be looking forward to next week?
Well, what we got all opening day next week, which is going to be just amazing. We're looking at CeCe Sabathia. I think is going to start the season in the bullpen for the Yankees because he's just not ready yet. Don't sleep on the Arizona Diamondbacks. That team has some really smart people in charge of it, and they not only brought in talent, they still didn't deplete their farm system. Their farm system is still one of the best in baseball. The Cleveland Indians, once again, have screwed things up. They got 17 outfielders for three slots, yet they have no pitching. It's amazing how Cleveland can't just get out of its own way no matter the sport. I want to see what the Mets do now that they're the hunted versus the hunter. And as usual, the St. Louis Cardinals will be there in the end because them and the Spurs are two organizations and the Patriots are three organizations that are in sports that I don't care what happens, they will always wind up making the playoffs when you swear this is the year they're going to fall. It doesn't happen. So that's the on-the-field stuff. A guy died this past week. A gentleman died. And kind of was given short shrift. It's really bothering me because he was a trailblazer and a pioneer for so many of these people who call themselves now sports entertainment. Joe Garagiola played for the St. Louis Cardinals. He was a broadcaster for them. He was also a broadcast for NBC when they were doing the Saturday game of the week. He's the reason I fell in love with the game of baseball. He's the reason I know as much about baseball history as I know. Because watching a game and listening to him, you got an education in baseball. You know, he talked about how, you know, you don't swing at the 2-0 pitch because the same pitch you get 2-1, you'll get 2-2, something that's lost in the game these days. Little things like that, how to turn the double play, all of those things he spoke about because he played the game and he coached the game while he was announcing a game. This is a man who did the morning, like the whole, remember they had a Good Morning America, NBC had their morning show. He was the first sports announcer to transition into doing that. So Bryant Gumbel and Greg Gumbel and all these people who are doing today and all this stuff, they never would have been able to do that without Joe Garagiola doing it first. Okay? He blazed the trail for all of these people to go in all these different directions as announcers and then start doing news and e-entertainment. Look how many of these people doing e-entertainment and all that came from ESPN and places like that. Yeah. And CNBC, you got Darren Rebell at CNBC. Darren Rebell started on ESPN. Okay? He was a numbers cruncher at ESPN, and now he works for CNBC, okay? This is the go-to guy now. People want to talk finances, talk about finances and sports and how much teams are valued at and all these things. None of these people would have been able to do this had not Joe Garagiola done it first and done it well. This is a man who transcended baseball. They talk about Yogi Berra as an American icon. And by the way, him and Yogi Berra grew up together on the same block. They played baseball together, standing on baseball together. They came up together. He's as much an icon in this country. He also served this country. He is as much an icon as Yogi Berra, yet you heard nothing about when this man died. The fact that people like Michael Kay can screw up a baseball game, you got these guys now who you don't know who was at bat, you don't know what the score is, you don't know how many outs they are because they're busy talking about what they ate last night. Yeah. Joe Garagiola allow these morons to get these jobs. And the fact that
Chandler, give me that comparison you gave me the other day when you were trying to explain to me how important he was as far as I think we cross-referenced basketball and baseball in saying, what do we use, Chick Hearn?
He and Vince Scully are the greatest baseball announcers ever. They're 1A and 1B. Chick Hearn would be comparable to Harry Carey.
Right, right.
Whereas it's a guy you're going to laugh, you're going to hear some funny stories, but you're not going to know a damn thing about what's going on in the game, and that's okay. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But Joe Garagiola would be more who?
Hubie Brown.
He would be more Hubie Brown. If you want to learn something, you listen to him. If you just did the broadcast because you want to listen to some jokes and have some laughs, then you want to listen to a Chick Hearn or a Harry Carey or a Bob Uecker. Those guys are all great, but they're technically, no, that's not, but they're great announcers in their own right. So mm-hmm. they're on the same level, but just for different reasons, is the way I put it, because you can't, you know, Chick Hearn was great, but Chick Hearn, listen, you listen to, if you got caught up and listened to Chick, you would not know what, anything that's going on in the game. You're like, damn, what's the score again? But you had a good time listening to the game, though. You yeah. had a great time listening yeah. to the game. And Joe was great listening to, but for a different reason, because he made you fall in love with the sport. He talked about the history of the game. He talked the Gas House Gang and Dazzy Vance and Joe Ducky Medwick and all of these guys. You're like, oh, man, I don't know about that. Red Shane Beast, you know what I'm saying? And the Big Cat, you know, Johnny Mize. You're like, well, who is that? And who is this? And By the Blue and Blue Moon Odom and Doc Ellis and the We Are Family. Listen. This man was a walking baseball encyclopedia, you know, because he lived it and played it. He started mm-hmm. out in the 40s. In the 40s.
Whoa.
Think about the amount of baseball this man saw.
Man.
He was qualified to talk about Babe Ruth.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying? He was qualified to say Babe was this good, and this guy's not that good, and I saw them both. And that man is gone, and nobody even noticed. And I think it's sad. I really do.
Well, I'm glad you were able to kind of hit me to him and let me discover who this guy was. And we'll revisit this next week when we do the show again with the full cast on it. I will definitely go back into it because I think, yeah, the light needs to be shown on it. And we're spending more time criticizing legends and how they're not in step with today, then we are respecting their body of work and the things that they were able to do. And that goes across all sports. But right now in this current time, we're really having a good time laughing at guys who we think are old and past their prime. And it's just old guys. No, we need to start respecting some of these legends and not only listening to the stories, but understanding what these sports are about. And they are about the memories that these guys can give you, the guys who were actually there, like you just said, 1940. The man played. That is a crazy, crazy amount of time and space that dude occupied. To go from then to 2016, that is crazy. But, yeah, man, we'll definitely get back into that next week or maybe Monday. But we'll definitely get back into that when we have a full cast on because I think more people need to know about this. I'm glad you brought the story up. But before we get out of here, anything you want to touch on before we go?
No, just still, you know, my nephew's still doing his thing, chickblademusic.com, doing his music and clothing line. Other than that, man, it's a lot of fun talking tonight.
Indeed, man. I'm up now. I was all groggy early before we started. Now I'm up and good to go. So, yeah, shout out to everybody who's ever called into this show, Speaking Like You Think It Radio. We'll be back next week with the full cast, and we'll really get into this NBA playoff race, some of these NFL off-signings, and, of course, the start of the MLB season. I might even go down there and check out the Suburban Braves now, whatever they call themselves, Cobb, whatever. Either way, man, we're up out of here. Chandler, thanks for calling. Check him out at NightChandler7 on Twitter. Have a sports argument with him. And no matter what he says, keep arguing. That's what I'm for. Well, yeah, we out of here, man. Thanks a lot, Chandler.
All right, bud.
Yep.